All right, so I will give a brief introduction to defects. I don't know how much the audience is non-homogeneous, so for some people will be redundant, for others maybe not as redundant. And then I will go into some applications where defects play a role, and I will talk about a natural system. These are chiral mnemonics. These are kind of biomaterials related applications. An industrial system, this is a spinning of carbon fibers. The precursor there is a discoric pneumatic liquid crystal. And if I reach to C, which I doubt, this is a research system, like rod-like, low molar mass and polymeric pneumatics along the lines that we heard earlier this week.
Being that everything you heard earlier being either natural or industrial is
irrelevant. Well, maybe. So we'll be talking about basically the pneumatic phase, which is orientationally ordered. I might have orientational order of rods or disks. So in, for uniaxial systems, we have a scalar order parameter and director orientation. For the first application, for example, I talk about chiral pneumatics. Chiral pneumatics are basically biaxial. So we have to augment this treatment with a tensor order parameter that is more general, is biaxial. So but the systems I talk about today have no positional order and there are no dislocations. Yes?
From the moment of terminology, you would call the squirtic part of pneumatic?
The what?
The squirtic phase is part of pneumatic.
Okay, so these discoric phases I'll be talking about, they are discoric pneumatics.
Okay.
Yeah. Then you have columnar phases.
Okay.
And hexagonal phases.
So pneumatic is basically covered everything.
Yeah. Yeah. So in terms of topological defects, if we have a long-range energy, like written down here, simple form by Frank, basically minimization leads to a Laplacian, and you want to look for singular solutions to this Laplacian. And depending on the geometry you are looking at, you might have points, lines, and other things, and loops, for example. So the singular solutions are defects. Defects have dimension, charge, and sign. For example, zero dimension are points. Lines, one-dimensional defects, are loops. And then we have these kind of inversion walls, which are non-singular solutions that I will talk a little bit. So we have the dimensional aspect of defects. We have the sign of a defect. The sign of a defect is determined by when you encircle a path, you travel around a path that encircles the defect. If the orientation rotates in the same way as the sense of your rotation, you have a plus defect. If you encircle the defect, you go around the defect and the orientation is reverse to your sense of path traversal, you get a minus sign. And the strength of charge of a defect denotes the amount of rotation when encircling a defect. For example, this is plus one, and this is plus one half. So point defects are singular solutions to Laplace equation in spherical coordinates. You end up with a Laplace equation, and in spherical coordinates, you look for a solution, an orientation field that is independent on the radial direction. So for example, here the director angle becomes proportional here to the azimuthal coordinate. And a solution here to point defect, these are the two director angles, and you see they're equal to the angular coordinates of a spherical coordinate system, and you end up with a point defect with the particular Clauber feature under cross-polars, and the energy associated with this type of defect is proportional to the size of the droplet. In droplets, I won't be discussing this, but there are other things. This defect might split into two. You have bipolar, and you might have rings, etc., but I just want to discuss a point defect here. The energy is proportional to the size of the droplet. We have line defects, so singular solutions in a cylindrical coordinate system. So the director orientation here is proportional to the angular coordinate of your system. And you might have all these singular solutions, different charges, since the energy of this defect is proportional to the strength of the defect square, you tend to observe, or what is mostly observed, are the low charge defects, plus 1/2 and minus 1/2. The energy increases downwards and depends logarithmically on the box size and the defect core, which I will describe in a minute. Yes, sir.
Well, for the hedgehog, you said drop the energy, you can have the core size in there. How do you calculate that energy?
Doesn't show up. It drops out.
It's not, there isn't a divergent.
Yeah.
There's a divergence there.
Yeah. Now, for the interact with each other, and you compute the energies of collection of two defects, for example, defect 1 and 2. These are minus 1/2 and plus 1/2. For example, the total energy per unit length of the system depends on three length scales, the size of the system, the separation distance, and the core size. So this is the interaction term that appears between the two defects that lead to the interaction force between the two defects. And the interaction force, you can see, is inversely proportional to the separation distance and directly proportional to the product of the strength of the two defects. Therefore, this shows that when the defect charges have opposite sign, the defects attract each other.
What was K?
K is the long-range elastic energy of the system. Is the communication. So all these models are based on the Frank energy. Simplest case, one constant approximation. If you start putting anisotropies here, different splay, bent, and twist, these interaction forces are much more complicated than you need. Well, you can do asymptotics. And things, instead of interacting directly, they might swing around a little bit, too. Okay, and this equation only holds when the separation distance is greater than the defect core. Okay, yes?
Is the entropy of the defects important?
Well, these are all free energy computations. For example, you can do dynamics. For example, you can do dissipative dynamics. Mm-hmm. And for example, if you do dissipative dynamics, the coarsening process, the interaction process, like we heard before, will have to involve some bulk flow, if you really do it carefully. And also, the change in distance will involve reorientation. So you have rotational dissipation effects at this level.
This is exactly the question that we asked on the board and that we tried to answer before. The entropy associated with changing configurations over long distances is very small compared to the energy for these light like defects. We found, by balancing the two, we found a length of about 1 angstrom, which I felt was a minimum. And then when we plotted the function, we found out it was a maximum in the function. So for anything beyond that, the entropy was negligible.
But what about the point?
I think,
it's a point that's still being studied, though, whether orientation or entropy needs to be accounted for in Frank elasticity.
I think that's what you are asking more. What I was thinking at this level of modeling, you know, so again, you have the dissipation function here. So you have a stress, you have a strain tensor, and then you have this kind of problems, a free energy variation, and the dynamics of the orientation. Now, I think what you're talking is what kind of entropic information I can put in there, right? And that's, for example, that's something people are investigating now entropy effects in the Frank elasticity terms.
Would that just mean evaluating the Frank elastic constant by taking into account the entropy of the
depth exactly.
of the state? That only amounts to assigning a numerical value to the Frank constants, right? But I thought that's not what you were talking about. Are you talking about the entropy of where you place the defects or how the defect line wanders? I mean, all. Which one were you, I mean, which one was, were you asking?
Well, maybe, okay, sorry, I shouldn't.
I'm not sure. basically looking at this, what you're doing is pretty much electrostatics, right?
Yeah.
And there are charges, and you have two wires interacting.
Yeah.
And I might think of that as reflecting the distortion of the director field, but the system might actually gain entropy from having a defect that can move around.
Yeah, that's the calculation we were doing.
Yes,
yeah.
So for point defects in thermal equilibrium, there's a density of point defects, but for displanations and dislocations,
But for point defects in a 2D pneumatic, it's essentially like Costelitz-Thouless, because the energy is a log and the entropy is a log.
Yeah.
So you can get a Costelitz-Thouless.
And get points in treatment.
Yeah. Okay. So then we have non-singular defects.
I have one question about interaction energy. Is it the energy of, if you have just two straight line defects, how does the energy go if you have them not parallel? Because what you told us about just now is...
Parallel. Yeah, then you have to, if you want to solve the exact problem, you have to do the pitch color computation, which, you know, you have to compute the stress field. I will mention the pitch color. We can also have inversion walls. These are non-singular defects. Jimmy was talking about in his simulations, observing under flow, the emergence of inversion walls. And for example, this term here in the free energy might be an orienting magnetic field. And depending on the orientation of the director field and the magnetic field, you might have, for example, twist inversion walls. And traversing the inversion wall, the director rotates by pi radians. You might have splay bend. The names twist, splay, and bend correspond to the elastic modes. When the wall is parallel to the field, you might have this type of splay bend wall. You can see that the director, when you traverse the wall, rotates by pi radians. And in this case, again, this is like Jimmy's wall. You have a splay bend wall, which is perpendicular to the magnetic field, and the lines go vertical at the center. Now, when you have this kind of inversion walls, there are pinching instabilities.
So the first two makes look like metastable configurations. The last one looks like it should.
Because you always have a degeneracy of rotation. If you have a uniform sample and you introduce an aligning field, things can rotate clockwise or anti-clockwise. So, for example, this is the simplest case to...
More specific, the last picture, I've got a cusp in the the lines following the director's continuous.
Yeah.
Right.
That's just... For example...
Right,
you satisfied?
Yeah, I wasn't picturing the magnetic field.
Okay, so and you can solve this, you can minimize the type of free energy, and you get this famous log tan solution, and this gives you the thickness of the wall inversely proportional to the field. And this field in this case is a magnetic field, but you can have these kind of walls forming under, for example, extensional flows. Right? You have commented in this type of phenomena how they form under stretching flows. And you can also have phenomena in which these walls rupture. I won't go over all this analysis, but the energy associated with the wall is just an elastic constant divided by the thickness of the wall, that's the surface tension. And so if the wall gets too thin, you can have an elastic instability, and these walls might rupture. And what you have here is this, the French school calls this pincement. Is my French good? Pincement?
Yeah.
Pensman, close enough. So you can see you have an inversion wall in the beginning, and there is an elastic instability to relieve this elastic energy, and you nucleate two defects. And since the wall had zero charge, after the nucleation, you have charge balance, and this is plus 1/2, minus 1/2. And so this is a way to anneal walls. So I think it's related to yesterday's talk, but I'm not sure. So if you have walls, they can anneal itself by pinching. And once you have these declination lines embedded in a wall, and this part of the wall is pulling on this defect, and this defect will move to the right. And in this way, this part of the wall, the wall will affect a sucking force on the line, and the line will move to the left. So the system anneals itself by elastic forces. Yes?
Is that an inversion phenomenon or an instability?
So you break down, you pinch the wall.
Right.
Yeah, there is a barrier. There might be dust particles floating around. There's always dirt. I agree with you. If you have a completely uniform ideal sample, you know, there is a barrier. There is a nucleation energy barrier, but there is nothing perfect.
Right.
There is,
and also you can make that barrier smaller by increasing your field.
Yeah.
You give a precise instability threshold, which I took to mean that there wasn't a barrier.
Yeah. This is in this approach. Well, yeah. This is the surface tension of this wall depends on the field thickness. I didn't show the nucleation energy here. I just wanted to mention this. But I have analyzed this problem with nucleation rates and nucleation barriers and so on. My message here is if you have walls, they can pinch. This is observed experimentally. They can pinch into lines, and then the wall kind of anneals itself.
No, but there's still some, I think it's Dave's question again. If you have an instability threshold, is it the case that there is a state without the defects and a state with the defects and a barrier in between, in which case that threshold is the limit of metastability, or is it isn't even a limit?
This threshold here reflects the type of perturbation I put. And it's driven by elastic anisotropy. So before you have splay bend and to nucleate these defects, the system has to escape and introduce twist. So what this threshold tells you is if you have enough elastic anisotropy, this type of evolution is possible. Then you have other thresholds.
But it's possible by continuously decreasing the free energy, the elastic.
Yeah.
No, there is a
this tells you that switching, you're reducing the energy of the system, right? But you see, this type of elastic energy doesn't take into account nucleation of defects because this is a director picture. So then you have to compute the energy associated with nucleating a defect, which I will comment now.
Is the right picture that there is an instability that draws you towards this kind of control,
yeah,
and eventually you have to produce a defect to finish the process.
Yeah. Yeah.
So that initial instability then is a change in character from the bend wall to a twist wall.
Yeah. Well, yeah. And this type of system, for example, might be applicable. This type of coarsening might be applicable when you have a sample and you see a lot of bands. You put a magnetic field, you have lots of bands, but the bands at the end, they disappear. And the question is how all these banded structures, they disappear under a magnetic field. So you have to come up with coarsening mechanisms, and this is one of them. Yes, sir?
Can you help me with the third dimension? Is your barrier going to be linear in the thickness of the...
Yeah, I know. Probably there is you know, three-dimensional phenomena because to nucleate is infinitely long. Here in the experiments, you're going to have a wall.
Right.
So they have bounding surfaces.
But they make a loop instead.
Or loops.
But loop would have trouble with the sign, right? Because the loop has to have this.
No.
Changes to twist as it goes.
No, it's, this is not true. You can have mixed loops. Part of the loop is plus 1/2, the other part is minus 1/2. You can have loops with zero charge that they shrink to nothing. Then you can have loops that have net charge that they shrink to. They leave behind the inclination points.
And this would have zero net charge.
This would have zero net charge.
But on the way around, it has to switch from wedge type to twist type.
Right.
What is what Michael said.
Yeah.
It can't be the same.
The
place given as.
Yeah. Okay. So this goes to how you, what kind of analysis you do on these effects. And so you have the configurational forces, and the configurational forces for pneumatics is the elastic stress dotted with a unit normal on a path encircling the defect. So this is the elastic Erickson stress tensor. And people that have to deal with fracture mechanics, all fracture mechanics is based on configurational forces. And so this type of integral was described first by Eshelby in the 60s, and he showed that the configurational force for pneumatic liquid crystals is just given by the Erickson stress tensor. And the name configurational force arises because if you have a system with a defect, the energy of the system depends on the position of the defect. That's why it's called configurational force. And if you use this formalism, again, you can have line-line force computations. I already mentioned this. The force between two disclination lines is the product of the two strengths divided by separation distance. You can compute loop tensions. If you have a loop, the tension is just the Frank elastic constant divided by the diameter of the loop. And you can compute line-wall interactions, as I described earlier. If you embed a disclination line in an inversion wall, you have a force pulling the disclination line, which is equal to the surface tension of the wall. All that comes out from this analysis of the configurational force. So what about defect line energies? To compute the energy associated with a line defect, you have a core energy and you have a long range energy. The long range energy, this is the energy per unit line length. So this is the long range contribution. You have the box size and the core size. And then you have a core energy. If you assume that the core energy is the energy of transition between the isotropic and the pneumatic phase, you can compute the core energy by minimizing this expression with respect to the core size. You get a core energy per unit volume, which you plug back in, and you find out that the line, the energy of the disclination line is proportional to the Frank constant, the strength square, and you have the core energy and the long range energy. This is factor one. Therefore, that tells you that when the box size is equal to 10 times the core size, the two contributions are the same. And that tells you that in these systems, when you are in submicron states, submicron geometries, you have to take into account the core energy into your model.
Saying it's 10 requires using specific. Yeah, you have log.
So yeah, right. Well, it's log. Log is log, you know.
No, I know. What I mean is that it could actually be more like 201. I you know, it's not so certain that you're going to get a big effect when the box is as big as 10 core sizes.
What this tells me, this simple computation tells me that when you have a lot of lines very close to each other, this thing of neglecting the core energy is not such a good approximation.
But that, that is presumably true even in crystals, right? And in dislocation of crystals, you can make the same argument.
Yeah. Yeah, that's what it comes from. So a few words about structure. What is the internal structure in this core? So you have far field, so what happens in the core? You might have plus one half, and people are interested because the core, the mobility of the declination line is affected by the structure in the core. And here you can express your tensor order parameter generally in terms of eigenvectors and eigenvalues. And what you want to describe is how the eigenvalues here vary with position as you enter the center of the core.
Actually, that was interesting. Is it true that a lot of the resistance to moving that thing comes from the core?
The core structure will be associated with the mobility.
Well, in principle, everything matters, but I might have thought that on dragging all of the structure around the object, that the resistance would have come largely from.
Well, as the okay, go ahead.
It comes from where you have gradients of the amplitudes. So where the gradients are the largest, you have the largest contribution to the friction. So it comes from everywhere, but it scales like the gradient of the amplitude square.
Okay, which is near the core.
And the core is largest.
If you have a straight declination line moving through a pneumatic, there's actually, in the limit of zero velocity, the mobility is actually ill-defined. It depends logarithmically on the system size.
Mm-hmm.
And so as a function of the force law is actually V log V or V over log V.
But if it depends logarithmically on the system, presumably it's logarithmically on the system size is over the core size. You need something else to make that work.
The point here is why this matters, because, for example, Clément has shown that if you have in a thermotropic LCP, if you have plus and minus declination lines next to each other, annihilating each other, they don't move symmetrically.
Mm-hmm.
One moves slowly, the other moves faster. And he shows that the mobility of these two lines, the differential mobility, arises because the core structure is different. And as far as I know, everybody has been searching for describing these structures that he observes, but by and large, people observe what I observe. If you want to describe the core, you take into a model that takes homogeneous contribution, a short-range contribution, and a long-range contribution. Right, and you minimize and solve this equation, and you find the eigenvalues, and typically these are the results people observe. This is on the left here is plus one half, here is two defects, this is plus one, and what I'm showing here are the three eigenvalues as a function of distance from the core here, and far away from the defect core, two eigenvalues are equal, that is, the system is uniaxial. So in this case here, two equal eigenvalues, this is the distinct corresponding to the director, and at the defect core, again, you have two equal and one different, the system, again, is uniaxial, and it goes through a region of biaxiality. And this happens in the plus one and plus one half. And in the center of the core, the system is negatively uniaxial. And outside the core, the system is positively uniaxial. And you can characterize the biaxiality with a biaxial parameter. And you get this biaxial torus structure. So this is the scalar that captures the biaxiality in your system. We plot this as a function of distance, and clearly you can see there is zero biaxiality at the center, and then you have a torus around the defect, which the system is strongly biaxial. And the whole point with this is it could be nice if we could find different type of orientation structures in the core, maybe more twisted or here everything is very simplistic. Everybody captures the same type of more or less structure. Biaxial torus, but nobody has captured this twist that Clément has described.
So this minimization of free energy with the full tensor cube.
Yeah.
And in Clément, what was he doing different?
Well, he was doing experiments. That's the big difference.
Experiment.
Yeah, he does fine scale experiments, and he's able to, through his experience, imagination, and instrumentation, come up with this picture of the core in a thermotropic liquid crystal when you have a defect of plus 1/2 and minus 1/2. There are other people here that are more knowledgeable.
There was a drop, and then there was a line that went down to the surface and came back up. So it ended at the free surface, but then these attracted one another, but one moved towards the other, but the other one didn't hardly move towards.
It wasn't pinned.
They were both free, but one is moving faster than the other.
Yeah.
And so then you imagine that this was in a polymer, that there was a lot of chain ends aggregating in the core of one of these defects. And because of that, then you have to move those chain ends with you.
Has anyone looked at the structure of the core in a direct simulation in some specific simple model, hard rods or?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, basically, yeah, he did that some years ago.
A short, well, we didn't do semi-flexible with this experiment that Klingman did. We did hard rock aspect ratio. We did a few different simulations, but one, say, with aspect ratio of 5, it gives a picture like this. And then aspect ratio of 11. It gave a different configuration, which is similar to having the rods line up in the parallel to the core, and then around it, this is all for minus a half wedge. Around it, there's a triangular region that's highly twisted, and then outside of that's the far field. So that was in 93, I think.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so this is active. There are many people pursuing this line of work, trying to better model the core of defects. So there's still a lot of activity.
One implication is that these complete models are going to be limited to some extent by their inaccuracy in describing.
Well, for example, in this model, for example, I have no splay bent anisotropy. So in this type of simulation. So that means I have two elastic constants. And I think if I have three elastic constants, a splay and bend can give you an additional degree of freedom. That's one thing we try to do. We need to see if there is the anisotropy can give you more structure.
So the degree of order goes smoothly to 0.
Here?
Yeah.
No, the center is not isotropic.
Wasn't that the top idea?
In general, it's not.
It's a pancake.
Yeah.
In the
middle. Yes.
Oh, and just one more comment about this defect course. There was one experiment by Joe Zabuzinski, who's here, but he did it before coming here. And this was electron microscopy of tobacco mosaic virus. And in that instance, also, he saw the wedge minus a half was basically having this.
Kind of structure you see.
Right. Similar, I mean, maybe.
Twisted.
Not enough, to make exact comparisons.
Mm-hmm. I have a general question about just using the Landau design approach to describe the detailed structure of pneumatics.
Yeah.
The pneumatic isotropic transition is described adequately in some ways, but quite inadequately in other ways by this. I mean, it's weakly first order by some measures. And not, I forget either the order parameter, is the order parameter jump is small, but the heat is big, or the other way around. I forget.
The heat is small, but
So, if you're going to take this seriously as a detailed description and go all the way to the core with it,
Well, but molecular theories, if you think about phase transition with Meyer-Soppy or Onsager, also you have a similar type of problem.
Sure, no, I agree. So the question therefore is, how...
Yeah. But for example, it captures a lot of, as I don't think I have time to get there, but in terms of topological phenomena during phase transition, you capture very nicely a lot of the features of defect nucleation and coarsening. Yeah, I mean, it's, you're truncating an expansion. But you do capture a lot of features, defect nucleation, defect coarsening, and points, lines, walls. So we believe it's useful. So my first application is chiral pneumatics. What about defects? I won't cover all the defects in chiral pneumatics. They're much more complex than achiral pneumatics. But the motivation here, what defects, what role they play in biological phenomena. So in terms of biomaterials, it is now generally recognized, for example, Bulligant, Neville, recognize that these arc patterns that are observed in analyzing many types of tissues, in invertebrates, in plants, and invertebrates. This is a picture of my knee after I ran the marathon. So you see, in all these different types of micrographs, we show the presence of very strong, robust feature, which is the arc pattern feature. So arcs appear everywhere in nature. This arc pattern is very robust and observed almost everywhere. And Bulligant was the first to recognize that the arc feature observed in natural materials is due to cholesteric organization. The twisted, he called it twisted plywood structure. So here you have fibrils, and the fibrils are rotating as in a cholesteric liquid crystal. And when you take a cross-sectional cut at an angle, what you observe is the arc pattern. So observation, morphological observations of chiral structure, when you observe it on an angular cut, right? So when you look at something, you want to cut it through, and of course you're not going to cut it through exactly like this. Most likely you're going to have an oblique cut. And the oblique cut, if you have chirality, twisting, you get an arc pattern. And this was established by Bulligant, and his school continues. He's a biologist, and Neville just wrote a book, those interested in this topic. Neville wrote this very exciting book, Cambridge University Press, 93, which is full of examples of observations and characterization of the arc pattern in biomaterials. So our idea is, Neville posed some questions which we thought we could pursue. And he said, well, according to his observations, he see that this arc pattern, the formation of chirality, always involved the strong influence of a substrate. And he called this the constraining layer. He sees that in these natural materials, they need a constraining layer to provide support for the helix to shoot up. And the helix orientation is vertical to the constraining layer. When we have a topography that is not flat and it kind of interacts with the pitch, when the wavelength of that topography is more or less the pitch of the cholesteric, he observes an array of declination lines at a distance close to the pitch. And so we want to try this to simulate, try to corroborate this hypothesis of Neville, and also observe what happens when we have other types of supporting layer. For example, if we have a helix axis that is parallel to the supporting layer, what's going to happen? So in this type of model, this is pneumatic, but has a superposed twist, and the structure has an internal length scale called the pitch. As you go through the pitch, the director rotates here by 2 pi radians. And typically, for most systems, this pitch is micron, submicron length scale. And we can put a lambda of the gen model here that is similar to the others. We have a short range energy and we have long range. This long range is a chiral, and the chirality enters in this expression here. So this is a Landau degen for cholesteric liquid crystals. And we have 3 length scales, the box size, the defect core size, and the pitch. U is just temperature, inversely inverse temperature. So we can minimize this expression and so and do some numerical computation with this equation. One thing I'd like to mention is that for cholesterics, it is generally now accepted, is that the cholesteric to pneumatic transition is affected by both temperature or concentration and the pitch. So this line is not flat, but it has an angle. Therefore, you can introduce a transition by temperature quenches or a pitch quenches. So we analyze this type of structure only by temperature quenches. We have a unit square. And since the constraining layer, the support is very important here, so we investigate different types of boundary conditions here. These two are periodic boundary conditions. And on the top, we use the no torque boundary condition. The no torque boundary condition is this piece here does not affect this piece here. Okay, so we do the quench, and we obtained front propagation types of solutions. These are the scalar order parameters plotted as a function of time. So as time progresses, we have a typical front propagation. You would observe for this reaction diffusion type of equation, the biaxiality you see here for this case is small, but this is what I mentioned before. Cholesterics are intrinsically biaxial, even rod-like. So for some cases, might be a good idea to do, and this was established by Mermin in his review article many years ago, where he explained the origins and the importance of biaxiality in this cholesteric.
Could you comment on that? Is it the nature of that biaxiality? Is it in the plane of the layer? It's squished that.
Yeah. So yeah. So so in fact, yeah. So typically in the phase plane, you get. So if this is S and this is P, the roots are not longer here. These are the cholesteric roots. You know, S is greater than 0. This is 0. This is 1. These roots don't live here anymore, but they start moving towards the biaxial, planar biaxial axis. As you decrease the pitch, this root goes up. This is infinite pitch, and as the pitch decreases tighter and tighter, you get that. But also, I failed to mention that for very tight pitch, we have the blue faces up here. All this region is called the blue face, is where the pitch size is of the same order of magnitude as the core defect core size. So this is isotropic, this is cholesteric. So what I'm showing you is something very close, very large pitch phenomena. There is no blue faces here. For people interested in blue faces. Okay, anyway, so we have this front propagation, directed growth type of solution. Here the message, so we can do some visualization of our results and taking a cat, and we see how the arc pattern grows as the front moves up, right? And this front is stable. There is no defects. I'm talking, my talk here is about defects. So where are the defects? They come in. Okay, so so this shows that Neville has said if you have a strong supporting layer, the only information we're given is the orientation here is planar and unique. So we don't give information of where the helix is. The helix is self-selected and goes up. Okay, so and the system, it has a fully relaxed wake. The wake is fully relaxed, monodomain. So this whole process, therefore, directed growth with support gives you a monodomain, which is an important question for people like Neville.
Should you say the pitch is vertical?
Yeah, so the in this case,
why are the lines going this way instead of out and getting dots in the middle?
Okay, so if I plot the director field here, it's going that way.
Okay.
It's just we took a slice,
okay.
Yeah, just to claim
sure.
That we do get arcs. These are not the director field lines, but the representation in the arc pattern by taking a cut. So in fact, this goes like this.
And
okay.
On that scale, where is the pitch? The pitch is sort of comparable to that scale? Or
yeah, comparable, yeah. Yeah. And what happens now when we put the helix parallel to the supporting layer? So this is the supporting layer. Now we put the helix parallel to the supporting layer, and we ask the question, what happens with the directed growth? Is there any stable front propagation? And the results are shown here. Yes.
So did you do this by homeotropic boundary conditions or by a boundary condition which actually rotates?
Yeah. Here I just put a perfect helix.
So you put a boundary
condition. Freeze it, yeah.
Yeah.
Freeze this helix and ask the question,
yeah.
Will the front propagate
right.
Where the helix parallel to the front? And what happens is you start getting bending at once, bending. So this is XY. So here the front is right here. And you can see the director lines now bending into arcs. And here the system progresses, moves up. And you see the arcs formed. And finally, later on, so you see now the arcs have formed, and now what happens at this point, which is equal to the pitch over 2, you have a set of an array of S minus 1 declination lines, and at this point, the helix orientation switches from horizontal to vertical. And then the front moves with a relaxed wake homogeneously. And the reason why it happens is that the front velocity is a function of director orientation. And in this, the other case, the director orientation was uniform. And here now you're sampling a distribution of director orientations. One is fast, the other is slow. And the resolution of this conflict is not the slowest wind or something, is the nucleation of an array of declination lines with a switch.
So the result really is a higher free energy than the simple solution.
Yeah. Yeah, you get now this frozen array of declination lines.
And those declination lines don't move.
They fix, they are all the same charge, minus 1/2. They separate at the distance equal to the pitch from each other, pitch over 2, from each other and from the bounding surface. and this is the scalar order parameter profile. This is the front, and this is the wake of the front with all the lines frozen in space. So doesn't matter what is the constraining layer, the system will always find a way to reorient the helix and grow by the nucleation of the defect lines.
Why don't they rebuild from the wall?
Well, he has defects on the wall.
No.
Of opposite strength.
No. When you put the pitch down, the boundary conditions you put on there,
well, they can go anywhere. It's energetically impossible because the helix now has switched. So it's impossible. They're stuck in there.
Not defects in the pneumatic, the defects in the atmosphere.
Yeah.
Changes their interaction with
yeah.
The
yeah.
There are rings?
For rings, I need 3D, Michael. But, sorry.
Oh, this was a 2D simulation.
Yeah. The student working with me on this, he's writing 3D code, and he will be able to do 3D now. Yeah, probably there are loops. Yeah. And so this kind of matches very nicely with Neville's hypothesis about growth, constraining layer, and other issues. Yes?
Could you calculate the biaxiality as a function of y?
We haven't looked at that.
Because it may be that
yeah.
Is stabilized okay. By an increase in biaxiality.
Okay. This is fairly new.
Yeah.
So, yeah. Now, so then we said, well, what happens? Yeah, so this is another picture. Just director representation, what happens? This is helix vertical, helix parallel, and where they meet, you have an array of declination lines. And here you can see the isotropic phase, and here is the front. And you can see this is the orientation representation. Where is dark, the orientation is in plane. And what is clear, the orientation is out of plane. And you can see here now some interesting phenomena in the isotropic phase, this kind of line texture that appears. This front will move. So at the end, you have all this section is a monodomain, defects, monodomain.
Yeah.
So what we did next was, let's say, let's remove the constraining layer and do periodic box. Periodic box, right? So we do the quench, periodic box. And now what we have is a suspension of S one-half, minus one-half declination lines that appear. And so, in fact, we started doing this work, we were using periodic boundary conditions. And we always end up with lots of minus one-half defects. And this pattern can be visualized. This is the director field. All the dots here are minus one-half declination lines. And now this in-plane structure continues to grow.
Paul Clay.
Oh, thank you. This continues to grow. All these meandering lines, you know, grow and grow because you don't want to have three ends.
Do you notice the pitches on this scale?
Yeah. And this is what it looks like. The orientation field that we get at steady state. And we get a beautiful grain boundary network with a distribution of heptagons, hexagons, and pentagons, which is fully stable. So this is a final steady state is a defect lattice of minus one-half defects.
So
comparable to the pitch less?
Yeah, this pitch.
Is this a blue face?
No, yeah, this is.
So it's a 2D analog of a blue face.
Well, but. But well, I think it's a 2D. I agree, but the characteristic distance here is much smaller than the pitch. So
characteristic what?
Core size here.
And the cell size is big, yeah. In the same way as the blue phase that had a big cell size. So that's
yeah. This is a cholesteric, you know, grain boundary network that you get. And, you know, this is fully stable, and you can do statistics and other grain boundaries and see, you know, like large grains are surrounded by larger grains, small grains surrounded by smaller grains, and follow what we know our grain boundary networks of other systems, magnetic systems, metals, and polymer.
Coarsen?
No. I don't know if we, yeah, no. Not we try different numerical methods, different approaches, finite elements, finite differences, finite different type of time integration methods, mesh refinements, different computers. yes, Mike.
My ignorance again.
No.
Is there charge conservation?
No. Everything is minus 1/2.
No, but I mean, before you start.
It's we quench from the isotropic phase. Isotropic.
The charge, in the initial condition state, the final state,
We do a random director field, S and P, very close to zero.
As you run your program, can net charge of a system change?
Yeah, well, the net charge of, you can see, well, at time zero, you have no topological defects.
But after you have all the defects.
Let's say once you identify the defects, then charge. Yeah. Changes at constant because if you
can. Well, I have to count all the defect ends that will become united with other lines. Let's see.
Well, it can't coarse it because they're all minus 1/2.
Yeah. And they are into.
You have a density of 1/2. The question is how do you start with it?
Yeah.
Right. Well, so if you start with a neutral system, the principle, why does it spontaneously create a
charge?
Why? Because inside the model you have this symmetry that tells you that the helix orientation doesn't have to be fixed everywhere pointing in the same direction. So what you have is these, you know, three-axis symmetry solutions embedded in this model that tells you that you can do have this kind of hexagonal symmetry phase, and it will appear because it's possible. There is only here minus 1/2. Minus 1/2 because.
Defect algebra is algebra.
Yeah.
Algebra magnetic defects is awful. I mean, for example, a half strength discrimination loop can shrink to make a plus 1 strength point.
Yeah.
So it's not the question of just adding.
Yeah, it's true. I agree with the comment here. I agree exactly with your comment.
Goes to plus 1.
This topological charge.
The algebra, 3D pneumatics, the algebra is not billion, so it's not just some adding numbers and things. It's awful.
So,
I cannot give a lecture, and I'm not competent to. I'm competent to make this remark. And then
what you have here. What you have here then is, if at these three points, right? If you have an equilateral triangle at these three points, these people decided to shoot up, you know. So this is what happens. You see, it fits naturally. And there is no anchoring, so this is equal to the Keble mechanism in pneumatics.
So
the Keble
cause
in the you won't have a charge conservation all the time, always. You know, so in this case, I start from zero charge, and I end up with a charged lattice that is fully stable.
Okay.
Yeah.
And the lowest energy state you think would be the honeycomb?
Well, now I can't perhaps put perturbations, put fluctuation, and see some coarsening process. I don't see too many of kind of lens defects here. You know, I haven't seen any kind of lensing or other stuff. So it's 5, 6, and 7 so far. So we'll have to see.
You could check, I guess, if the three-point junction should be 120 degrees.
Yeah. We have a lot to check, but...
lowest energy wouldn't be the dispersion. So this is not lowest energy, it's just the stable, metastable state.
Yeah, it's stuck in a...
Lowest energy would be perfect for...
I can put...
you have to stability. It's also have to measure all the conditions.
Lowest energy is a big spiral, it's a positive state.
This is quenching without any other information. Quenching in a periodic box. So we started this, and Neville's question is, why does nature produce cholesteric monodomains? That was the original motivation of this work. And so what we investigated is, if you have a nice supporting layer, you have front propagation, we have no defects, etc. Now, if you start doing phase ordering without a supporting layer, you end up with defect type of textures. And it has been important for people in this field trying to explain what is the origin of monodomains.
It's also important for people who grow semiconductor crystals.
Okay. Yeah.
Right. People who do epitaxy.
Okay.
Know this too, right?
Yeah.
If you want to make a nice silicon crystal, grow it from a...
Yeah. Yeah. Right.
What happens if you do start from a homeotropic rather than a pitch surface?
Well, it will depend on the cell thickness. If the cell thickness, the box size is very small, you can end up with an emetic phase also.
If it's small compared to the pitch.
Yeah, it's small compared to the pitch. Okay, so the other system, the research system, I definitely won't be covering. So. This is the other system. I try to mention a few things. Carbonaceous mesophases. These are used in the manufacture of carbon fibers. There are three ways to produce carbon fibers. PAN fibers, pitch carbon fibers, and rayon fibers. Carbon fibers are very expensive in general because they need a strong heat treatment. So these are all based on carbonization at high temperature for a lot of time. So there is always a driving force to come up with ways to produce high-performance carbon fibers at a cheaper price per pound, and people have been doing that by using the pitch, petroleum coal tar pitch precursors. So in this type of precursors, you can have isotropic pitches. They give you more low-quality fibers, and the high-performance fibers are obtained using liquid crystalline precursors. So this type of liquid crystals are discoric pneumatics and form from the polymerization of these low molecular weight compounds. By dehydrogenation, you get the formation of more disc-like, board-like structures as observed here. The 1 nanometer is the length scale. So you can take this with a grain of salt. There are some problems here I have to discuss. You can take the uniaxial approach, the disc-like pneumatic approach, or you might also have to resort to modeling this system as biaxial, calamitic type of phase. And how do we... No. So this gives you a distribution from a natural petroleum pitch. This is a mass spectrogram. It gives you the molecular weight. And roughly 500 is a good number. So these are relatively low molecular weight systems. And this is a typical structure. So there is a wide distribution of molecular weights. And Brooks and Taylor, working in Australia in the late 60s, doing optical microscopy, found out that these systems are pneumatic liquid crystalline systems. They work in the Cole Institute in Australia. And
are they deeply pneumatic, or if you could turn off the polarization, are they needed in carrying point?
Well, more or less, nowadays, people also work with synthetic pitches. Mitsubishi has the naphthalene synthetic pitch. So you can get more stable pitches using these synthetic approaches. But roughly, the phase transformation goes through a phase inversion. It's like a polymerization-induced spinodal decomposition of some kind. You have an isotropic phase, and you have spherulitic growth due to the polymerization process. So you have polymerization. When the molecular weight exceeds some kind of critical value, the system phase separate into spherules. They grow, and they impinge this phase inversion, and the impingement of the droplets is here, and you end up with a defect type of liquid crystalline phase. And this was well characterized by Brooks and Taylor. And also, as I mentioned now, by G.L. White in UC San Diego, who's done most of the work. So this, if we take the view of, as discoric pneumatic liquid crystals, so this is the long-range elastic energy. They again display splay, twist, and bend. And the twist elasticity now is the most costly, so these kind of systems will tend to give you planar structures. So there is a nice correlation. Many people have studied the reversal of anisotropies comparing reeds, disks, and rods. For example, Hess has done a lot of work on this type of analysis. And G.L. White is the person that has characterized the microscopy and the morphology. White wrote this review article, Advances in Liquid Crystals, in 82. And these are all the types of defects he saw and all the types of defect interactions. He saw plus one, minus one half, and plus one half. And he was able to observe all these type of interactions. I guess he's a very patient person. And these are cartoons, when you have a discoric type, what type of disclination lines you have. Basically, yes?
So these, in order to escape, they would twist and so they bounce?
These are interesting issues. Escape, yeah. For example, he has observed here singular and non-singular plus one-half defects. He has characterized that. And in fact, what he observes is many times is mixed cores, scape and singular in one line.
Yeah, I guess you could, the figure on the left, if you enclose that with a spherical cap, then that would be escape. And so that seems to be a stable structure.
Yeah, well, for example, this shows this overhead here shows the presence. This is microscopy. It shows the presence of plus one half, minus, and plus one half. And he rotates the cross polars and shows the presence of the three together, singular, one half.
S equals plus one here is also singular.
Yeah. Well, he has observed singular and scape. And mixed. Part is singular, the other part is escaped.
Is that because some of the some barrier to the escape to happen, or is it that
One of the interesting ideas is, for example, if you suppose you have flow, right? Suppose you have flow and you have a escape structure, and the orientation of the line is along the flow. So you're going to have a director that has the lowest viscosity. On the other hand, suppose you have a escape disk. Now the disk, the director is along the line, but the disk is associated with the highest viscosity. You have a disk flowing like this. So some kind of dissipative arguments might change. Also, the other interesting points I don't have time to talk about is for discotics, that, well, the twist is the hardest. So in this Landau degen, we always use L1 and L2, both positive. Now, for this system, L2 is negative and has some implications. So the people that work with this, finally, they make money by spinning these things into fibers using the melt spinning process. So you have pitch reservoir, you have capillary flow, conversion flow, you have extensional flow, and you have a solidification line, and then the fiber goes into further down by processing, by oxygen diffusion, so that the system sets into a graphitic structure and heat treatment. But all the morphological processing occurs in this part. And so they use different types. This is called the spinneret, and the spinneret can have different geometries, and you can have circular cross-sectional fibers, and you can have ribbon cross-sectional fibers.
And where are they used?
The aerospace, where you want a lot of strength and lightweight. Tennis rackets, running shoes.
This is what they refer to as a graphite reinforcement fibers?
Yeah. So these are some type of characteristic cross-sectional fiber structures. And so you can see here a defect line. This is called radial structure. And this is a bipolar, planar bipolar, with defects close to the rim. And these are other types of ribbon shaped. And you have defects line. And in this case, you have a ribbon with a line structure following right here. So the question that people in this industry had is, when you spin these fibers at higher temperature, you tend to observe this structure. When you spin them at lower temperature, you have it at, in this structure. And typically, these fibers, here is a scale, a micron. Sometimes the fibers are thinner than this, so you would think that curvature elasticity is important. So what we did is just investigate what curvature elasticity does, and these are sanitized, clean-up type of textures. So here you have a planar radial, you have one defect here, you have a pure bend deformation mode. And this is a planar polar texture. You see you have a low energy core here, and you have 2 plus 1/2 defects with splay and bend. So you have bend, and you have splaying. And this is observed at high temperature. This is a low temperature. Of course, there are more phenomena, but you see the robust features of these textures are the presence of these topological defects under constraint from the surface, in which the director, in this case, in both cases, aligned tangential. So we did some.
Do we think of the disks as being parallel to those lines, or the pneumatic? So
the director here is tangential. It's perpendicular. This is side view, and these are the views of the layers edge on. So that's why this is a pure bend structure, and this is a splay bend. So we did quenches of this system, tried to analyze what elasticity does, and come up with a phase diagram, a fiber texture phase diagram. This is the temperature increasing upwards, and this is the dimensionless fiber radius. It's scaled with a defect core size. The horizontal is the clearing temperature. And we can see that for very small fibers, We are good at doing nano simulations. So we can do this very nicely. But so when the fibers are small enough, we get a planar radial. When big enough, you have a bipolar. And we have the presence of a chimney here that extends a long way. So this explains our simulation, well, agrees with the observation of from the field. At higher temperature, you tend to observe planar radial. At lower temperatures, they always see what they call it Pan Am texture. Pan Am texture. Okay, and we can fit this texture transition line with a simple power law model. R here is the ratio of short to long range, and U is the inverse temperature. So this model shows that, and the simulations show that this part of the transition line is just governed by geometry. So you can go from one texture to the other by only geometry, system size, and here the phase transition is governed by temperature and geometry.
And temperature here is just your T minus TC parameter in the Landau design.
This U is TC over T.
Yes, it's just the coefficient of the order parameter squared.
Yeah. And so if our simulations to obtain this diagram, we are here, we quench it. We quench and ask with boundary conditions set what texture appears. Right?
At long times,
yeah.
Does a lot of coarsening happen before you
settle? Well, if you are right here, yeah, a lot of coarsening. Yeah. Like here, there is very little defect nucleation. Yeah, so exactly. So what the explanation for this is when the core size is of the same scale as the fiber, is the same thing as if you want to share a studio apartment with somebody else. There is no room, right? It's not good enough, so you can fit two cores with one fiber because they are the same scale. So, right, so you only get one defect. And when you are here, you get two defects, right? And like Pat mentioned, if you are up here, you can have coarsening. Many defects appear and some they coarsen out and you get only two defects. And the charge here was +1/2. And here, again, it's +1/2. And you can have, for example, phenomena arising as follows, the dynamics of this Pan Am texture by just splitting a defect core. So this shows radial splits into two, and they coarsen, they travel towards the rim, and they stop at a distance that depends on the elastic anisotropy. If bend is equal to splay, the distance is equal to the fourth root of 5.
Okay.
Right here. So this is the defect distance as a function of anisotropy. And I can put anisotropy by adding a term, so making splay different than bend. And so bend more costly, the defects go to the rim, and bend decreases. I go through isotropic case, 1/√5, and they decrease, and then you only obtained, for very weak bends, you only obtain this radial texture. And this is a nice result that you can get by solving the following problem. If you solve Laplace equation for the director with two singularities with the fixed boundary conditions, and you put the image charges here, and that gives you the geometrical constraint and the force balance. And when you solve that problem, you get this number. And then the simulations seem to agree pretty well with that number. Okay, so the next thing, my time is almost up, but what happens when you have ribbon shaped fibers, the spinneret here, people use different types of geometries, and the reason why they do that is because it turns out that the heat transfer properties and the strength of the fibers is improved. For example, if you have a radial texture, like this, which is purely radial, you're going to generate tangential stresses in this case. And that's why you see a lot of breakup fibers that look like this. They're missing one sector because of the stresses. So, for example, to avoid these things, people to also improve heat conductivity. They use different type of geometries, and they always have something like, has some defect at the center, and others have the ribbon-like structure. So, since I don't have time, I just put the ribbon-like, which is more fancy. So you have a ribbon-like with a line here, a line defect. And if you analyze this picture, you have two inversion walls connected by a defect at the center. On the left, the director rotates in going up from 0 to minus pi. And on the right, it rotates from 0 to plus pi. So this inverse rotation sense, that's why you have to have a defect there. And these lines here are taken as inversion walls, as I discussed earlier. And this is what you would expect if you have S plus one singularity in some kind of orienting field. So people have already solved this kind of problem for other reasons. If you have a defect and you blast it with an orienting field, what you're going to end up with is the defect plus some inversion walls floating around. So this shows walls here, wall there. So it's an orienting effect. And so to come up with this picture, since this coric orients the director along the compression direction, rods orient along the extension direction, disc orients the director along the compression. There might be other possibilities, but we use that approach and put a planar extensional flow, which is not a bad approximation from actual observations. That is, in this case, this thickness doesn't change as you move downstream in the spin line, but this thickness changes as you move down on the spin line. So we put this planar extensional flow from this kind of bent texture and increase, and at some point you start getting strong walls at this line. So it is expected that it's a flow effect that exists on the spin line. And so this is just a splay bend wall, and you can also reproduce that with a very simple torque balance equation. So these are elastic torques, and this is flow torques. If you solve this simple equation, you get similar equation I showed you earlier, a splay bend inversion wall, where the driving force here is the Erickson number for this extensional flow. So so the third application I was going to talk to you is some other time. Next time you organize this symposium to explain this kind of phenomena, like you were talking about. You start with isotropic phase, you quench it, and you end up with this coarsening process is self-similar, and you have defect lines, you have annealing. So you can simulate these kind of things with this Landau-Degen approach. And with this approach, you can compute the nucleation of defects. That's the only difference. With this approach, you nucleate how many defects they nucleate as a function of quenching depth. And then you can describe some features of this process.
You're doing 2D simulations?
Yeah, 2D so far. Although my colleague Sushi, he's done 3D now.
So which we should think of this as 3D, sort of uniform in one direction and.
Yeah, but 3D is where all the loops live, and I think that's where should be done, 3D. I mean, it's...
Alex, on the graphite problem?
Yeah.
In the real process, is it in the isotropic phase upstream, or is it both in the mathematical?
No, they mainly spin mesophase pitch.
So I'm picturing a large number of defects in that large pool, and then yeah. It's coming down to 1 micron. Eventually, when it has 1 or 2 defects trapped, they needed to unwind the boundaries?
Yeah, well, there is a lot of annealing throughout the way.
It's a pretty fast process. I don't understand.
Yeah, but at least the macro features of this texture, probably there is much more at the level I described it here. But the robust features of this micron size is a few defects floating around, you know, at the center or close to the rim, or you have a robust line declination. Maybe there are other types of sub-micron features that live at smaller scales.
If the depth number is large, and if you're going through some sort of extensional flow, then you forget about the topology of defects, you can just wipe them out by molecular phenomena. So by straightening the, stretching the chain.
Well, just actually,
if you'd like, just sending it through a phase transition in order to remove the defect or something else.
Some interesting experiments by G.L. White, who is in UC San Diego, close by, he's a neighbor. He put meshes. So in the flow path, he put metal mesh. And he can study nucleation of defects when the liquid crystal goes through the mesh. And these are very nice experiments. And so the mesh pattern is imprinted into the liquid crystal, and it survives for many, many strains. And so it's a fascinating, well, they claim it shows the memory, long-lasting memory of the system, and how the defects don't anneal as easily.
So the product that you get when it goes through
the
mesh, it's
porous. Yeah.
What are the mechanical properties? Is it almost solid-like because it's so full of defects, or what? And what is it?
These are viscoelastic systems. Viscosities are comparable to other pneumatic systems.
No, what I meant was the stuff that after going through the mesh, it's got a lot of defects. Yeah. So are the mechanical properties so?
They haven't characterized that. So in fact, so what they do is they put this metal mesh. No, they haven't done that. So the system flows through this mesh, right? And then what you get is the liquid crystal is a defect lattice.
Yeah.
That each of these mesh points becomes a defect point with the same charge.
Mm-hmm. That's what I want to know. So now you have a network of some sort permanently.
Yeah.
I mean, in there. And so I just wondered if it's sort of weakly solid-like or it's kind of like gel. What is it?
They haven't done that.
When you said the viscosity is like typical pneumatics, did you mean pneumatic polymers or small molecule pneumatics?
I think it's more like in between both of them because of molecular weights. The viscoelasticity is not characterized at all. It's just starting.
I'm wondering about the Deber number.
Yeah. Well, some observations they do with rheometry is, in terms of viscosity is, they do have observed something like this. This is shear rate. This is apparent viscosity. This is around 100 reciprocal seconds. So they do see thinning at low shear rates. These are, 0.5 reciprocal seconds. Then they see a plateau. Then they use other type of means and they investigate this area. And they see a second thinning region. But I don't know if, for example, thermal effects are something to consider at this.
And then it's faster.
Yeah.
I think from other talks I've seen you give, the hypothesis here is that these materials are shear aligning.
Yeah, that's my hypothesis, yeah. But I don't have direct evidence. But, well, sorry, I take it back. Latest experiments from rheometry, and they open the system up, and they polish, and they study orientation distribution by Tony Cato. He shows that there is a critical shear rate. They call this a kink. At this point, the system, if this is your shear cell, after this kink, mainly the director is close to the velocity gradient. So these are the disks. So it's pointing very close to the velocity gradient as in flow aligning. And below that, you have a distribution of directors that lives mainly in the velocity vorticity plane. And very little along the velocity gradient. That's what the observations he obtained. And the structure here has much more defects. It's very, you know, it's using the analogy used in this group, kind of broken up in small type of domain structures. And at this point, what you see, what he observes, is these small kind of domain structures. And then you have this large kind of monodomain structure where the orientation is well aligned.
And that's the kink in the curve.
Yeah. And you're right. So this mode kind of starts growing from, it's like a recrystallization type of problem. It grows from all the small domains and appears in different parts of the sample and grows and grows. But they have done the characterization very close to this area.
Just below that area, is there actually coexistence? You're saying this coexistence of this orientation and this other thing?
It's the orientation lives mainly in the velocity vorticity plane.
Below the 0.5, it's, as you approach that kink, it's a mix of two orientations.
Yeah, they don't have a clear orientation. And very small, refined structure. And at this point, you start getting something like a monodomain, and the predominant orientation is along the velocity gradient, which is the orientation of a flow aligning system.
Their samples are black, so it's a little bit difficult to study.
Yeah, very difficult to have section, yeah. But they have done it. Yeah. So, yeah, in my thinking is that these systems are flow aligning. Mainly based on these actual observations.
Yeah. But is that flow aligning intrinsically in the linear limit, or is it a non-linear transition tumbling to flow aligning? Because for a disk like thing tumbling, you would actually expect it to probably the director to migrate towards the vorticity direction.
Yeah. It could be, yeah, that's, but they seem to,
there's something else up there.
This up there, you know, and also the molecular weight of these things are 500, you know, or the very low molecular weight. Less than 1,000.
Are they near glass transition?
I think the high shear rate drop off.
I don't know that. Yeah.
Well, the stuff is called pitch.
Pitch, yeah.
It must be near glass transition.
Quite distant.
Well, but I think also the name pitch is refers to, you know, the optical characteristics. And well, also I should say that the best characterization for these experiments refer to the synthetic Mitsubishi pitch. Mm-hmm. This is synthetic pitch, and in which the best representation of the molecular structure is calamitic, is biaxial.
So you need to be thinking that just about
I think this view of this cotic is not as good as the real life. It's more board-like. So that's a big complication. Okay, thank you. Thank you.